It's 1900 UTC, and that means it's time for That's News to Me. I'm your host, DJ Marcus. Let's see what's happening in the world today.
Oh, hello, hello, welcome, one and all. It is 1902 UTC. I'm a little bit behind. I was trapped in what some might call Meeting Hill. So, deep breaths. We're going to go ahead and connect on comm. Just SSH over to STF. Type comm, C-O-M, and then press G for go to, and then a non-radio. When you go to a non-radio, boom, you're in the room where we can all chat and talk and hang out with people like Tobe and SMJ, Ratsu. And, oh, look, we got some new people. LeGamer server and non-FXNL. That was, they were here the other day. So, oh, and Harry Larry. Wow, just everybody's around. It's a good time. Thanks so much for being here. All right, well, besides being in Meeting Hill, I don't want to talk too much about work because, you know, that can be a little hairy sometimes, if you catch my drift. So, let's go ahead here, click our sync button in Firefox, and launch our bookmarks. And it's time to start kind of the way we always start, almost always. There was that one time.
World news.
All right. So, first up, we're starting off in China. Hong Kong Tiananmen Square commemorations in pictures. So there's a bunch of photos, but the thing I wanted to mention is people in Hong Kong are marking the 32nd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, but in a much more muted way than in previous years. Macau and Hong Kong are the only places in China where people can commemorate the anniversary of the deadly 1989 crackdown by Chinese soldiers on pro-democracy demonstrators in Beijing. Estimates of the dead vary from a few hundred to several thousand. But for the second year running, authorities in Hong Kong have banned an annual vigil for the event. They cite the ongoing coronavirus pandemic for the restrictions. Officers closed off Victoria Park, where the annual vigil is normally held, and dispersed crowds who gathered with candles or their phone lights lit. This year's anniversary is the first since a new controversial security law was approved, aiming to end the city's pro-democracy movement and criminalizing dissent. On Friday, officials arrested pro-democracy activist Chow Hang-tung, vice chairwoman of the Hong Kong Alliance, which organizes annual vigils for victims of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. Thousands defied last year's ban on the vigil, knocking down barricades around Victoria Park. But this year, commemorations are so far more constrained. The new security law passed in 2020 makes it easier to punish protesters and reduces Hong Kong's autonomy. So, there you go. Don't forget. don't forget Tiananmen Square. And if you're in China, especially don't forget Tiananmen Square. And learn about it if you don't know about it. Oh, man. Non-fictional. Okay. I will try to remember that. Thank you for... that's totally different. Okay. Not sure. We'll just go with it. All right, so let's keep on a rolling. This one's got a little trigger warning about sexual abuse and assault. The next two stories do, actually. First up, an Australian woman who spoke out about her rape in Parliament, triggering Me Too protests nationwide, is receiving care in hospital for her mental well-being. Brittany Higgins, 26, entered hospital last Thursday. David Shiraz told news outlets she was taking time to recover after months of unrelenting political pressure. Ms. Higgins' case has sparked anger over a culture of sexism and misogyny in Australian politics. Since speaking out in February, she's called for reform to parliament culture and inspired other Australian women to report their allegations of sexual assault. In March, it led to tens of thousands of people around the country joining protests against sexual abuse and discrimination of women. A number of lawmakers in federal and state parliaments have been accused of sexual assault and misconduct this year, including Government Minister Christian Porter, who strongly denied accusations he raped a girl when he was a teenager. Mr. Porter on Tuesday dropped his lawsuit against the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for the report on the allegations. Despite political pressure, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has declined to investigate the claims, after police ruled out a criminal investigation because the alleged victim had passed away. Mr. Morrison has also been widely criticized for his government's response to allegations from Ms. Higgins, a former staff minister member for two ministers. So this will be very interesting to see what ends up happening. The way that the headline, I didn't read the headline because it's very victim blamey. So I'm trying to be optimistic, but I'm not very hopeful that we'll see meaningful change there. All right, and then the next story. Now we go down in age from high school to kids. German cardinal offers to resign over sexual abuse catastrophe. Cardinal Reinhard Marx, one of Germany's most senior Catholics, has offered his resignation to the Pope over the catastrophe of sexual abuse by clerics and other church members. Marx, the Archbishop of Munich and Freising, and prominent liberal, said in a letter to Pope Francis that he wanted to share responsibility for the abuse that had taken place over decades and the failure of the Church to deal with it. He said the Church had reached a dead end, and his resignation was a way of helping to indicate the possibility of a new start. I have to share responsibility for the catastrophe of sexual abuse by officials of the Church over past decades, he wrote in a letter, which was sent on May 21st and published on the Archdiocese website on Friday, after Francis gave permission. Marx had apologized to victims of sexual abuse in the past. In April, he turned down the Federal Cross of Merit in acknowledgement of victims' groups' anger over what they viewed as the Church's inadequate response. In a press release, the Munich Archdiocese said Francis had allowed Marx to make the letter public and had urged him to remain in his role until he had received an answer. So, let's see. What's going on in Con here? Conversation in Calm is always fun and is a reason to join up. Join SDF, just SSH over is new at sdf.org, and you can follow the prompts right there from your terminal. Super fun and super easy. Let's keep it moving. Let's talk about COVID now. Pushpa Torakskar, whose mother-in-law was hospitalized with COVID-19 in April, was told she had to pay $2,070 in hospital bills within 24 hours. A few hours later, she got another call from the hospital informing her that her mother-in-law, Parvati, had died from the virus. "We couldn't claim the body till the dues were cleared," Torakskar told me, teary-eyed. As a farm worker, it would have taken 30 months for Torakskar to pay the bill out of pocket. So like many families in India that now face stiff medical expenses due to the pandemic, she borrowed money from a local lender at an exorbitant interest rate of 10%. "I knew we couldn't afford a private hospital," said Torakskar, who lives in a village named Nagave Dumala in the Indian state of Maharashtra. We had to try to save her, no matter what. Torakskar's apprehension toward public hospitals stemmed from hundreds of stories of deaths. From her village alone, over 10 people died in the district public hospital after being diagnosed with COVID-19. But even the private hospital, where Parvati was being treated, was running low on essential supplies, to the point where the hospital had asked Torakskar to help obtain antiviral drugs and other medicines. "We ran everywhere and dialed over 200 people," she said, "but we couldn't find any leads." One of the main reasons that Indian hospitals lack supplies like vaccines is because while India is a major hub for vaccine production, many of the millions of doses that were created earlier this year were slated specifically for export. So when a second wave of COVID-19 cases swept across the country in March, India, unlike the United States or most European countries, was shipping out far more vaccines than it supplied to its own population. So that's part of the tragedy going on in India right now. There's a lot more if you go to progressive.org. This is from the magazine, the Progressive magazine. And so it's just, debtors' prisons scare me, and someone holding your loved ones hostage after they've dead is kind of wild. All right. All right, so we've moved on. We're going to go ahead and start talking about some other stuff. Muslims near India's Hindu temple allege pressure to vacate homes. Javed Akhtar, 71, has lived all his life in his 100-year-old ancestral house built by his grandfather. The house is located just a few meters away from a famous Hindu temple in northern India's Uttar Pradesh state. Akhtar, a retired engineer with the Indian Railways, says Gorakhpur district officials, including the police, visited his house recently and took measurements of the surrounding land. The next day, he was asked to sign a consent letter, which said the resident living on the southeastern side of Gorakhnath Temple had given their consent to transfer or hand over their lands and houses to the government for the safety of the temple premises. "We have no issues, and as of our consent, we have our signatures as followed," reads the letter, with the names and signatures of residents concerned. Nearly a dozen families, all from minority Muslim community, living in the vicinity of the temple, were asked to sign the consent letter, with the signatories alleging they have been asked to vacate their houses. Arctor told Al Jazeera that he saw a few families had already signed the letter. "The official told us that if we don't sign the letter, they have other ways to get our signatures. We were pressured," he said. So, wild, wild stuff. With a population of 220 million, nearly 20% of the Muslims, Uttar Pradesh has long been a flashpoint for religious tensions, which intensified after the BJP came to power in 2014. Last month, the local administrators in the state's Barabanki district demolished what Muslims in the area claimed was a 100-year-old mosque, causing anguish in the community. So, it's very scary stuff. Uttar Pradesh, if you're not aware, is that far north, that northern province, and that was where we were having lots of breakouts, well, because people didn't believe, like, COVID-19 was real and stuff. Pretty wild and scary stuff. Kind of reminds you of, or reminds me of, the Israeli conflict going on.
Ouch!
All right. Well, hold up a second. It's already 14 minutes after? What is going on?
Get the news over with. I want to hear the music.
Oh, man. Oh, golly. Let's figure this out. It isn't caste system related. This is, what happened? Oh, bye. Have a good time. And I was like, oh, shucks. I am all over the place. I'm still fired up about the meeting that I left. I abruptly left the meeting and was like, all right, goodbye. I put up a countdown timer on my clock on screen with my image, so that they knew I'm leaving. And then when the timer ran out, they still kept going. So I was like, goodbye. All right. All right. Well, where are we at?
Get the news over with. I want to hear the music.
I've got two stories, and then we're going to do some music, okay? First up, this is in Minneapolis. Yesterday, or earlier this week, there's been a place called George Floyd Square, which is the spot where the block where he was killed. They barricaded the street and had a kind of sit-in protest there. Well, the city came in and started removing it and tearing it down earlier this week. And then now, just earlier, two deputies have killed a man in Minneapolis. So police keep killing people. Surprise, surprise. But here's the story. Crowds vandalized buildings and stole from businesses in Minneapolis' uptown neighborhood after law enforcement officers on a U.S. Marshals Service task force fatally shot a man they were trying to arrest for illegally possessing a gun. Authorities did not immediately release the name of the man killed in the shooting Thursday, but a woman who was in a longtime relationship with him identified him as Winston Boogie Smith Jr., a 32-year-old father of three. The woman, Shelley Hopkins, said Smith, who was black, had been harassed by police since he was in high school. She feared he'd been killed when she heard about the shooting, then saw his vehicle on the news. While she was at the scene, she got a call from the medical examiner's office confirming his death. "We have a very big spiritual connection, and my intuition kicked in and I just had a feeling," Hopkins said. "I knew something wasn't right. I didn't want to believe it." Authorities said Friday that members of the U.S. Marshals Fugitive Task Force were trying to arrest Smith on a warrant for illegally carrying a firearm when he was shot. The Marshals Service said in a Thursday statement that Smith, who was in a parked car, didn't comply with law enforcement and produced a handgun, resulting in task force members firing upon him. Yeah, I don't know. I don't particularly trust or believe the Marshals Service when they say that either. Anyway, the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is leading the investigation, said Friday that two sheriff's deputies, one from Hennepin County and one from Ramsey County, were the officers who fired their weapons. The state investigators also said evidence indicates Smith fired his gun, saying a handgun and spent cartridge were found inside the car. The U.S. Marshals Service said task force members attempted life-saving measures, but Smith died. State investigators said a 27-year-old woman, who was a passenger in the vehicle, was taken to hospital and treated for injuries from glass debris. The U.S. Marshals Service, not really a big surprise here, the U.S. Marshals Service does not allow body camera usage for officers in its North Star Fugitive Task Force, and there's no squad camera footage of the shooting. Surprise, surprise. Anyway, I had to be sure and let you know because, anyway, there's no such thing as a good cop. And what else is going on? Here's a good piece of news. Oh, man. Native American tribe in Maine buys back island taken 160 years ago. The advert painted an idyllic picture of White's Island. For $449,000, you could buy 143 acres of forest with sweeping views of the rugged shoreline of Big Lake in Maine, on the east coast of the United States. It's a unique property steeped in history, with only two owners in the last 95 years. In fact, Kuwisui Monhi, Pine Island, is its original name, and it technically has just one true caretaker, the Passamaquoddy, a small tribe of 3,700 Native Americans who'd lived there for at least 10,000 years. It's a spiritually important place for the tribe, filled with graves from devastating smallpox, cholera, and measles outbreaks caused by white settlers. In 1794, it was officially granted to the tribe by Massachusetts for their service during the Revolutionary War. But after 1820, when Maine became its own state, colonialists changed its title, voiding the treaty. In the 1851 census, there were 20 Passamaquoddy living there. In 1861, there were none. By 2021, they had not only lost all but 130 acres of their original 3 million, they hadn't stepped foot on Pine Island in 160 years. I'm getting agitated, sorry. You know what happens when I get agitated? You know what? That means
get the news over
it's time
with.
To play some music that's less agitating. That's what it means. Deep breaths. It's all going to be okay. All right. Oh, hold on. Where'd it go? Aw, crap. I had a song pulled up, and it totally is missing. Let's see if I can find it. Oh. Well, I can't find it, so this is called War Sucks, Let's Party.
Underground Radio is your non-commercial, non-profit, member-supported underground radio station.
Powered by the SDF Public Access Unix System.
That is correct. 100%. That is right. This is an on-radio powered by SDF. You're listening, so you know that. But check it out. Check it out. It is 1922 UTC right now, and you're listening to news to me. This show goes on till 1930 UTC, and at which point, guess what happens? The most exciting time of the non-radio world. It is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. Woo! I wish I had a da-da noise.
That's correct.
But, yes, I don't know. It's a recreation of the droid noise, so I'm not sure. But, boom. So, Dubious Goals Committee with Tobes coming up at 1930 UTC. That happens every single day. News to Me is a Monday through Friday show, so we'll be back on Monday. And after Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, I believe we've got Harry Larry. Let's check the schedule. All you got to do is hit enter, or excuse me, the equal sign in com, or go to anonradio.net. And, boom, we can see there, something blue. Or, no. Is it something blue? It says something blue slash mix remix. I don't think that's right. Let's go to anonradio.net. Oh! Let's be sure and throw that out there. Do, do, do. Today is Friday. Yes, it's Something Blue with Harry Larry. Mix remix is on Mondays. Alright. And tomorrow. Oh, sorry. I got thrown off because I'm trying to make sense of this schedule and it didn't jive with my head. That. What is going on? Oh. Well, that's no fun. Alright. Sorry. I'm a little thrown off here. Alright. Yeah. So then tomorrow at 1900 is Publius has a show a step further out than Dubious Goals Committee. And then A New Way of Thinking with DJ Freedom. Last week they weren't around, but maybe they'll be here next week or be here tomorrow. We'll figure it out. Oh, welcome, Jazz Mess. Thanks for tuning in. All right, so let's keep on rolling. Man, sorry. My sales have deflated. All right, Bobby Wine has made some news. Uganda's opposition leader, Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, alias of Bobby Wine, has told Africa News that the human rights situation in Uganda has worsened since the January 14th election. Veteran ruler Yoweri Museveni was declared the winner of the controversial vote and was sworn in for another term in May. The election campaigns were dominated by episodes of deadly violence against Museveni's opponents and their supporters. Hundreds of opposition activists and supporters have gone missing in post-election crackdown by security forces. Africa News sat down with Wine at his home in Magir near Kampala to talk about Uganda's unfinished election and his party's new role as the official opposition. And you can check that out at Africa News. Make sure I give you the full URL. It's africanews.com, and it's one of the top stories today. So check it out if you want to hear that interview. We also have word from Nigeria. Nigeria is going to suspend Twitter indefinitely. We talked about this yesterday, where their president had his tweet threatening war deleted. Well, Nigeria's government is suspending Twitter operations in the country indefinitely. The ban is due to the persistent use of the platform for activities capable of undermining Nigeria's corporate existence, a statement said. Twitter said the announcement on Friday was deeply concerning. It comes just days after a tweet by President Muhammadu Buhari was removed for breaching the site's rules. The statement from the Nigerian government did not mention the row over the removed tweet, but Information Minister Lai Mohammed previously criticized the U.S. social media giant's decisions to take it down, calling it double standards. The site, which was still available to users in Nigeria following Friday's announcement, removed a tweet sent by Nigeria's 78-year-old president on the 1st of June. It referred to the 1967-70 Nigerian Civil War and treating those misbehaving today in the language they will understand. A Twitter spokesman said at the time that the post was in violation of Twitter rules, The account owner will be required to delete the volatile tweet and spend 12 hours with their account in read-only mode. The statement gave no further details. So, we'll see what happens there. Twitter has a long history of being more sticking to its rules and treating poorer countries more, I guess, the United States and Western Europe gets to do kind of whatever they want on Twitter. So, great. What else is going on? We're running out of time. Bitcoin is in the news. Elon Musk, who I guess can't live without being in the limelight, tweeted that he was breaking up with Bitcoin. The value of cryptocurrencies dropped after Elon Musk tweeted a meme which implied he was breaking up with Bitcoin. The Tesla CEO posted a meme about a couple breaking up over excessive quoting of Linkin Park lyrics. Mr. Musk shared the meme with hashtag Bitcoin and a heartbreak emoji. So he then posted another ambiguous post linking a breakup with falling prices. He's known to manipulate the markets and then reap the rewards with that. Hey, it's not regulated, so it's not like it's illegal. And that's kind of the motto of the U.S., really. Hey, it might be unethical, but is it illegal? Oh, silly person. We have guns. Nothing's illegal for us. What else is happening? Oh, yeah, U.S. troops, armed with assault rifles, mistakenly stormed a privately owned sunflower oil factory in Bulgaria. They were taking part in a NATO military exercise with the aim of clearing the airbase next door, but ended up at the wrong coordinates and encountered civilian workers. The incident happened on the 11th of May. No shots were fired, and the U.S. Embassy in Bulgaria says it's fully investigating the cause of the mistake. I don't know. We're out of time. Enjoy the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe.
Well, that sound means that our time's come to an end. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow, and every weekday, Monday through Friday, before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe at 1900 UTC. Talk to you then.